The Swiss. Chapter 8. Zwingli's Toils and Fatigue. Zwingli did not spare himself. Such great and continued toil called for relaxation, and he was ordered to repair to the baths of Pfeffers. Oh, had I 100 tongues, 100 mouths, and a voice of iron, as Virgil says, or rather had I the eloquence of Cicero, how could I express all that I owe to you, and the pain this separation causes me? Such were the parting words of Hieris, one of the pupils resident in his house, and who thus gave utterance to the feelings of all who knew Zwingli. He departed, and reached Pfeffers through the frightful gorge formed by the impetuous torrent of the Gemina. He descended into that infernal gulf, as Daniel the Hermit terms it, and arrived at those baths, perpetually shaken by the fall of the torrent, and moistened by the spray of its broken waters. Torches were required to be burned at noonday in the house where Zwingli lodged. It was even asserted by the inhabitants that frightful specters appeared sometimes amid the gloom. And yet even here he found an opportunity of serving his master. His affability won the hearts of many of the invalids. Among their number was the celebrated poet, Philip Ingentinus, professor at Friburg in Briscoe, who from that time became a zealous supporter of the Reformation. God was watching over his work and designed to accelerate it. Strong in frame, in character, and in talents, Zwingli, whose defect consisted in this strength, was destined to see it prostrated, that he might become such an instrument as God loves. He needed the baptism of adversity and infirmity, of weakness and pain. Luther had received it in that hour of anguish when his cell and the long galleries of the convent at Erfurt re-echoed with his piercing cries. Zwingli was appointed to receive it by being brought into contact with sickness and death. There is a moment in the history of the heroes of this world, of such as Charles XII or Napoleon, which decides their career and their renown. It is that in which their strength is suddenly revealed to them. An analogous moment exists in the life of God's heroes, but it is in a contrary direction. It is that in which they first recognize their helplessness and nothingness. From that hour they receive the strength of God from on high. A work like that of which Zwingli was to be the instrument is never accomplished by the natural strength of man. It would wither immediately, like a tree transplanted in all its maturity and vigor. A plant must be feeble, or it will not take root, and a grain must die in the earth before it can become fruitful. God conducted Zwingli, and with him the work that depended on him, to the gates of the sepulchre. It is from among the dry bones, the darkness, and the dust of death, that God is pleased to select the instruments by means of which he designs to scatter over the earth his light, regeneration, and life. Zwingli was hidden among those colossal rocks that encircle the furious torrent of the Gemina, when he was suddenly informed that the plague, or the great death, as it was called, had broken out at Zurich. It appeared in all its terror in the month of August, on St. Lawrence's Day, and lasted till Candlemas, sweeping off 2,500 inhabitants. The young men who resided in Zwingli's house had quitted it immediately, in accordance with the directions he had left behind him. His house was deserted, but it was his time to return to it. He hastily quitted Pfeffers, and reappeared in the midst of his flock, which the malady had decimated. His younger brother Andrew, who had waited for him, he immediately sent back to Wildhaus, and from that hour devoted himself entirely to the victims of this frightful scourge. Every day he proclaimed Christ and his consolations to the sick. His friends, delighted to see him unharmed amid so many deadly arrows, experienced, however, a secret alarm. "Dear Duty," said a letter from Ball, written by Conrad Brunner, who himself died of the plague a few months afterwards, "but at the same time remember to take care of your own life." This caution came too late. Zwingli was attacked by the plague. The great preacher of Switzerland lay stretched on a bed from which he seemed likely never to rise. His thoughts were turned inwards. His eyes were directed to heaven. He knew that God had given him a sure inheritance, and venting the feelings of his heart in a hymn overflowing with unction and simplicity, of which, though we cannot transfer the antique and natural language, we will endeavor at least to exhibit its rhythm and literal meaning, he exclaimed, "Lo, at the door I hear death's knock. Shield me, O Lord, my strength and rock. The hand once nailed upon the tree, Jesus, uplift and shelter me. Willest thou, then, death conquer me in my noonday? So let it be. Oh, may I die, since I am thine. Thy home is made for faith like mine." Meantime his disease increased in virulence. his despairing friends beheld this man, the hope of Switzerland and of the church, about to fall a prey to the tomb. His senses and his strength forsook him. His heart was dismayed, but he still found strength sufficient to turn towards God and to cry, "My pains increase. Lord, stand thou near." Body and soul dissolve with fear. Now death is near, my tongue is dumb. Fight for me, Lord. Mine hour is come. See, Satan's net is o'er me tossed, I feel his hand. Must I be lost? His shafts, his voice alarm no more, for here I lie thy cross before. Canon Hoffman, sincerely attached to his creed, could not bear the idea of seeing Zwingli die in the errors of which he had preached. He called on the provost of the chapter, and said to him, "Think of the danger to which his soul is exposed. Has he not designated as innovators and fantastical all the doctors who have taught these 380 past years past and more Alexander Hales, Bonaventure, Albertus Magnus, Thomas Aquinas, and all the canonists? Does not he maintain that their doctrines are mere visions, which they dreamt in their cowls within the walls of their cloisters? Alas! It would have been better for the city of Zurich had Zwingli ruined our vintage and our harvest for many years. Now he is at death's door. I entreat you to save his poor soul." It would appear that the provost, who was more enlightened than the canon, did not think it necessary to convert Zwingli to Bonaventure and Albertus Magnus. He was left in peace. The city was filled with distress. The believers cried to God night and day, praying him to restore their faithful pastor. The alarm had spread from Zurich to the mountains of the Tockenburg. The pestilence had made its appearance even on those lofty hills. 7 or 8 persons had died in the village, among whom was a servant of Zwingli's brother Nicholas. No letter was received from the reformer. "Tell me," wrote young Andrew Zwingli, "in what state you are, my dear brother. The abbot and all our brothers salute thee." It would appear that Zwingli's parents were dead, from there being no mention of them here. The news of Zwingli's malady, and even the report of his death, was circulated through Switzerland and Germany. "Alas!" exclaimed Hedio in tears. "The preserver of our country, the trumpet of the gospel, the magnanimous herald of truth, is cut down in the flower and springtide of his life." When the news of Zwingli's decease reached Baal, the whole city resounded with lamentations and mourning. Yet the spark of life that still remained began to burn more brightly. Although his frame was weak, his soul felt the unalterable conviction that God had called him to replace the candle of his word on the empty candlestick of the church. The plague had forsaken its victim, and Zwingli exclaims with emotion, "My God, my sire, healed by thy hand, upon the earth once more I stand. From guilt and sin may I be free. My mouth shall sing alone of thee. The uncertain hour for me will come, o'erwhelmed be perchance with deeper gloom. It matters not. With joy I'll bear my yoke, until I reach heaven's sphere." At the beginning of November, as soon as he could hold a pen, Zwingli wrote to his family. This gave unutterable joy to his friends, particularly to his young brother Andrew, who himself died of the plague in the following year, and at whose death Ulrich wept and groaned, as he himself observes, with more than woman's sorrow. At Baal, Conrad Brunner, Zwingli's friend, and Bruno Amerbach, the celebrated printer, both young men, had died after 3 days' illness. It was believed in that city that Zwingli also had fallen. The university felt the deepest dejection. "Whom the gods love die young," said they. But who can describe their delight when Collins, a student from Lucerne, and after him a merchant from Zurich, brought intelligence that Zwingli had escaped from the jaws of death? The vicar of the Bishop of Constance, John Faber, that old friend of Zwingli's, who was subsequently his most violent antagonist, wrote to him, "Oh, my beloved Ulrich, what joy I feel at learning that you have been saved from the grasp of cruel death. When you are in danger, the Christian commonwealth is threatened. The Lord has pleased to urge you by these trials to seek more earnestly for eternal life." This was indeed the aim of the trials by which God had proved Zwingli, and this end was obtained, but in a different manner from that imagined by Faber. This pestilence of 1519, which committed such frightful ravages in the north of Switzerland, was in the hands of God a powerful means for the conversion of many souls. But on no one did it exercise so powerful an influence as on Zwingli. The gospel, which had hitherto been too much regarded by him as a mere doctrine, now became a great reality. He arose from the darkness of the sepulcher with a new heart. His zeal became more active, his life more holy, his preaching more free, more Christian, and more powerful. This was the epoch of Zwingli's complete emancipation. Henceforward he consecrated himself entirely to God. But the Reformation of Switzerland received a new life at the same time as the Reformer. The scourge of God, the Great Death, as it swept over these mountains and descended into its valleys, gave a holier character to the movement that was there taking place. The Reformation, as well as Zwingli, was baptized in the waters of affliction and of grace, and came forth purer and more vigorous. It was a memorable day in the counsels of God for the regeneration of this people. Zwingli derived fresh strength, of which he stood so much in need, from communion with his friends. To Myconius especially he was united by the strongest affection. They walked in reliance on each other, like Luther and Melanchthon. Oswald was happy at Zurich. True, his position there was embarrassed, but tempered by the virtues of his modest wife. It was of her that Galerian said, "If I could meet with a young woman like her, I should prefer her to a king's daughter." Yet a faithful monitor often broke in upon the sweet affection of Zwingli and Myconius. It was the canon Zylochtecht inviting Oswald to return to Lucerne, his native place. "Zurich is not your country," said he. "It is Lucerne. You tell me that the Zurichers are your friends. I do not deny it. But do you know what will be the end of it? Serve your country. This I would advise and entreat you, and if I may, I would command you." Zylochtecht, joining actions with words, procured his nomination as headmaster of the collegiate school at Lucerne. Oswald hesitated no longer. He saw the finger of God in this appointment, and however great the sacrifice, he resolved to make it. Who could tell that he might not be an instrument in the hand of the Lord to introduce the doctrine of peace in the warlike city of Lucerne? But what a sad farewell was that of Zwingli and Myconius. They parted in tears. "Your departure," wrote Ulrich to his friend shortly after, "has inflicted a blow on the cause I am defending, like that suffered by an army in battle array when one of its wings is destroyed. Alas! Now I feel all the value of my Myconius, and how often, without my knowing it, he has upheld the cause of Christ." Zwingli felt the loss of his friend more deeply, as the plague had left him in a state of extreme weakness. "It has enfeebled my memory," wrote he on the 30th of November 1519, "and depressed my spirits." He was hardly convalescent before he resumed his duties. "But," said he, "when I am preaching, I often lose the thread of my discourse. All my limbs are oppressed with languor, and I am almost like a corpse." Besides this, Zwingli's opposition to indulgences had aroused the hostility of their partisans. Oswald encouraged his friend by the letters he wrote from Lucerne. Was not the Lord, at this very moment, giving a pledge of his support by the protection he afforded in Saxony to the powerful champion who had gained such signal victories over Rome? "What is your opinion," said Myconius to Zwingli, "of Luther's cause? As for me, I have no fear either for the gospel or for him. If God does not protect his truth, who shall protect it? All that I ask of the Lord is, that he will not withdraw his hand from those who hold nothing dearer than his gospel. Continue as you have begun, and an abundant reward shall be conferred upon you in heaven." The arrival of an old friend consoled Zwingli for the departure of Myconius. Bunsley, who had been Ulrich's instructor at Bâle, and who had succeeded the Dean of Wiesen, the reformer's uncle, visited Zurich in the first week of the year, and Zwingli and he formed a project of going to Bâle to see their common friends. Zwingli's sojourn in that city was not fruitless. "Oh, my dear Zwingli," wrote John Glothen not long after, "never can I forget you. I am bound to you for that kindness with which, during your stay at Bâle, you came to see me, a poor schoolmaster, an obscure man, without learning, merit, and of low estate. You have won my affections by that gracefulness of manner, that inexpressible suavity with which you subdue all hearts, nay, even the stones, if I may so speak." But Zwingli's old friends profited still more by his visit. Capito, Hedio, and many others, were electrified by his powerful language, and the former, commencing in Bâle a work similar to that which Zwingli was carrying on in Zurich, began to explain the gospel according to St. Matthew before an ever-increasing auditory. The doctrine of Christ penetrated and warmed their hearts. The people received it gladly, and hailed with acclamations the revival of Christianity. This was the dawn of the Reformation, and accordingly a conspiracy of priests and monks was soon formed against Capito. It was at this period that Albert, the youthful Cardinal Archbishop of Mentz, desirous of attaching so great a scholar to his person, invited him to his court. Capito, seeing the difficulties that were opposed to him, accepted the invitation. The people were excited. Their indignation was roused against the priests, and a violent commotion broke out in the city. Hedio was thought of as his successor, but some objected to his youth, and others said, "He is Capito's disciple." "The truth stings," said Hedio. "It is not safe to wound tender ears by preaching it. But it matters not. Nothing shall make me swerve from the straight road." The monks redoubled their efforts. "Do not believe those," exclaimed they from the pulpit, "who tell you that the sum of Christian doctrine is found in the gospel and in St. Paul. Scotus has been more serviceable to Christianity than St. Paul himself. All the learned things that have been ever said or printed were stolen from Scotus. All that these hunters after glory have been able to do is merely to add a few Greek or Hebrew words to obscure the whole matter." The disturbance increased, and there was cause to fear that, after Capito's departure, the opposition would become still more powerful. "I shall be almost alone," thought Hedio. "I, a weak and wretched man, to struggle unaided with these pestilent monsters." In these circumstances he called to God for succor, and wrote to Zwingli, "Animate my courage by frequent letters. Learning and Christianity are now between the hammer and the anvil. Luther has just been condemned by the universities of Louvain and Cologne. If ever the church was in imminent danger, it is now." Capito left Baal for Mentz on the 28th of April, and was succeeded by Hedio. Not content with the public assemblies in the church, where he continued the explanation of St. Matthew, Hedio proposed in the month of June, as he writes to Luther, to have private meetings in his house, for the more familiar communication of evangelical instruction to those who felt its necessity. This powerful means of edification in the truth and of exciting the interest and zeal of believers for divine things could not fail, then as in all times, to arouse opposition among worldly-minded people and domineering priests, both which classes, though from different motives, are unwilling that God should be worshipped anywhere except within the boundary of certain walls. But Hedio was immovable. At the period when he was forming this good resolution at Baal, there arrived at Zurich one of those characters who, in all revolutions, are thrown up, like a foul scum, on the surface of society. The senator Grebel, a man highly respected in Zurich, had a son named Conrad, a youth of remarkable talents, a violent enemy of ignorance and superstition, which he attacked with the most cutting satire. He was blustering and passionate, caustic and ill-natured in his speech, void of natural affection, dissipated, speaking loudly and frequently of his own innocence, and seeing nothing but evil in his neighbors. We mention him here, because he was afterwards destined to play a melancholy part. Just at this time, Vadian married one of Conrad's sisters. The latter, who was studying at Paris, where his misconduct had rendered him incapable of walking, feeling a desire to be present at the marriage, suddenly, about the middle of June, appeared in the midst of the family. The poor father received his prodigal son with a kind smile, his tender mother with a flood of tears. The affection of his parents could not change his unnatural heart. His good but unhappy mother having some time afterwards been brought to the verge of the grave, Conrad wrote to his brother-in-law Vadian, "My mother has recovered. She is again ruler of the house. She sleeps, rises, scolds, breakfasts, quarrels, dines, disputes, sups, and is always a trouble to us. She trots about, roasts and bakes, heaps and hoards, toils and wearies herself to death, and will soon bring on a relapse." Such was the man who somewhat later presumed to domineer over Zwingli, and became notorious as one of the chiefs of the fanatical enthusiasts of the day. It may be that divine providence allowed such characters to appear at the epoch of the Reformation, to form a contrast by their very excesses with the wise, Christian, and regulated spirit of the reformers. Everything seemed to indicate that the battle between the gospel and popery was about to begin. "Let us stir up the temporizers," wrote Hedio to Zwingli. "The truce is broken. Let us put on our breastplates, for we shall have to fight against the most formidable enemies." Myconius wrote to Ulrich in the same strain, but the latter replied to these warlike appeals with admirable mildness. "I would allure these obstinate men," said he, "by kindness and friendly proceedings, rather than overthrow them by violent controversy. For if they call our doctrine, which is in truth not ours, a devilish doctrine, it is all very natural, and by this I know that we are really ambassadors from God. The devils cannot be silent in Christ's presence.